Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm journalist Jonathan Curiel and I'll be the moderator for today's program called The Rabbi's Night. We also welcome our listening and internet audiences and invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my extreme pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Michael J. Cooper. Dr. Cooper is a pediatric cardiologist who is the author of two novels. The latest is titled The Rabbi's Night. Dr. Cooper also volunteers providing medical care to needy children in the West Bank. Would you please welcome Dr. Michael J. Cooper?
Thank you very much for coming and welcome on this beautiful day. I'd like to first ask if anyone has actually read The Rabbi's Night. Okay, so for some of you, for most of you, this is a situation where I don't want to have to issue spoiler alerts because there are lots of twists and turns of the plot. And when one is writing historical fiction, one can certainly create situations, especially if it's set in the 13th century, that are somewhat imagined, but certainly set in the time frame and the matrix of the history of that interesting period at a pivotal moment at the transition from the Crusader Kingdom of Jerusalem to the Mamluk Caliphate. And again, in a place, the Holy Land, which certainly is the crossroads of empire. So I would like actually to begin with telling you something about the book, but again, not wishing to spoil it. And in this context, I'd like to tell a little joke, and I want to apologize for those who've already heard it, but it's a question of revealing too much. A woman is walking through an Orthodox Jewish neighborhood in the Bronx, and she sees chickens hanging in the window of a certain establishment. She goes in, she asks the proprietor, "How much is that nice big chicken in the window?" He says, "I'm sorry, madam, I don't sell chickens." "What do you mean you don't sell chickens?" "I'm a moel. I do ritual circumcisions." "I know what a moel is," she says, "but why do you have chickens hanging in the window?" He says, "What do you want I should have hanging in the window?" So in some respects, one must be careful not to reveal too much. With that in mind, I just want to read from the flyleaf that I know will be safe in regards to not having to issue any spoiler alerts. The year is 1290. The place is the Holy Land at the twilight of the Crusades. War-weary Knight Templar Jonathan St. Clair is garrisoned in the port city of Akko. In possession of an ancient scroll with a cryptic inscription, St. Clair becomes more interested in learning Kabbalah than fighting Muslims when he learns that the inscription holds the key to unlock the secrets of Jerusalem's Temple Mount. But no Jewish scholars in Akko can decipher the inscription, and time is running out. Akko will soon come under siege, and the one man able to divine the scroll's meaning, Rabbi Samuel of Baghdad, has been targeted for assassination. Deep in enemy territory, St. Clair apprentices himself to Rabbi Samuel, and together they travel to Jerusalem. On their pilgrimage, they are hunted by scheming emirs in the service of a treacherous rabbi of Akko, a bitter enemy of Rabbi Samuel, and aided in their quest by others, a brilliant young scholar, Isaac of Akko, a powerful young Scotsman, William Wallace, a learned Muslim mathematician and cartographer in Jerusalem, and the beautiful, independent-minded woman Zahira, who avoids serving in an emir's harem by hiding among lepers in a colony on the shores of the Sea of Galilee at Tel Chum. Ultimately, Rabbi Samuel and St. Clair find they must risk everything to fulfill their shared and sacred destiny as guardians of the Temple Mount. So that's just an overview of a book that, again, is set at the end of the 13th century. I want to do just a couple of quick readings to give you a flavor, and then we will talk about the context of the book from the standpoint of who wrote it and why. this basically is a point in the book that takes place when St. Clair has traveled from Akko to the mountain village of Safed, or Tzat in Hebrew, to seek out Rabbi Samuel. He then goes with Rabbi Samuel to the leper colony at Tel Chum, where the rabbi repays the colonists, the lepers, by basically offering to examine everybody to find out who actually has leprosy or who has just has a skin condition. And, you know, there was a fair amount of confusion, and he certainly feels that he might be able to help some of the residents of the colony by relieving them from this living death of being in a leper colony if indeed they perhaps don't have true leprosy. They also at that point, as I said in the introduction, meet this woman Zahira, and St. Clair is of course struck by her, and his vows of celibacy are sorely tested. And these are his thoughts as they're about to leave this colony before dawn. St. Clair lay upon his pallet as the dark hours passed. Sleep did not come. As he listened to the sound of the rabbi's even breathing, he yearned for the oblivion of dreamless sleep. Turning onto his back, he stared into the darkness, his mind racing with thoughts of the woman, the unblemished smoothness of her olive skin, the feral beauty of her eyes. Enough! He sat up and crushed his hands against his closed eyes, his heart pounding in his chest. I must not give rein to such thoughts. He lay back and drew a deep breath as he willed his thoughts away from her. All our provisions are packed, and we'll leave after dawn, finally to complete the journey to Jerusalem. I'll observe the Mamluk preparations along the way and make report to the temple. But his mind's eye turned again to the woman, the surprising perfection of her, but more than that, the fierce conviction of her mind with such speech as I have never heard from a woman. He recalled her words, "It will be my intention, it will be my choice." In the darkness before dawn, he could hear her speaking in his mind. He got up, shrugged into his robe, and pushed through the tent flaps, the night air cool on his skin. The Galilee was a dark glass beneath the fading canopy of night, silent but for the sound of water sliding over smooth stones. Standing by the lake, he closed his eyes and sought the shelter of the day's first prayer office. He began to feel better, more like himself. Once done with lauds, he sat on a boulder waiting for dawn. High in the eastern sky, a leering crescent moon with upturned horns obliterated all but the brightest stars. The moonlight dimly lit the tents along the shore. In one of the tents was the woman. I can't stop thinking about her. The smiling moon seemed to mock his misery. From behind, he heard the rabbi's sandals clicking on the stones along the shore. You're not praying this morning, Jonathan? I did lauds early. He felt the rabbi's hand on his shoulder. Did you sleep at all? No. It's the woman, isn't it? My vow forbids any commerce with women. The rabbi sat on the boulder next to St. Clair. This woman is dangerous. All women are dangerous, murmured St. Clair. But this one stands between me and God. He looked out over the Galilee, brightening under a russet sky. Is the lake not beautiful, Jonathan? Yes, Rabbi, it is beautiful. Do you not love to bathe in it, to feel the water on your body? All right, Rabbi, I grasp your meaning. The rabbi put his arm around the knight's shoulders. Jonathan, do you believe God is served when you deny the beauty of his creation? Pulling St. Clair closer, he asked, do you truly believe that God wants you celibate? What manner of question is that? St. Clair shrugged off the rabbi's arm, hopped down from the rock, and trudged down the shore to the edge of the marsh. Then, as quickly, he returned, planting himself in front of the rabbi. How can you ask me such a thing? Am I not a knight of Christ? Celibacy is central to my calling. Why? Where is that written? In the rule of the Templars, St. Clair barked and turned away, set down long ago at the Council of Troyes. And is there a scriptural basis for the celibacy? Of course there is, St. Clair paced angrily. In the letter to the Hebrews, the rabbi stroked his beard. I don't recall any directive in the letter to the Hebrews concerning celibacy, and I've studied it very carefully. You have? Why? Because I'm a Hebrew. The letter was addressed to me, so I read it. Rabbi Samuel raised his shoulders. Tell me, Jonathan, where do you believe the epistle speaks of celibacy? In the verse, strive to bring peace to all. Keep chaste, without which no one can see God. Keep chaste? No. The Aramaic word used in that phrase is kedushutach, meaning sanctified, not chaste. That's the word I recall. Who cares what you recall, thundered St. Clair, startling a flock of mud hens that pattered away and labored into flight. Another quick reading. As they move along the shore of the Galilee, they continue this conversation, much to St. Clair's chagrin. Following a narrow path along the shore, St. Clair and Rabbi Samuel left Tel Chum, wearing the cowled gray robes of wandering Muslim scholars. The air rang with the song of blackbirds hidden in the marsh grasses. At a rock bluff that left no room along the shore, the path led away from the lake, winding upward between thistles and boulders of black basalt. St. Clair turned, waiting for Rabbi Samuel to labor up the low hill. As he drew near, St. Clair could hear the rabbi speaking. The Aramaic is quite unambiguous. Perhaps it's a question of translation, sanctity or chastity. Strange to think how lives can turn by the translation of a single word. It's not the single word, Rabbi. It's the discipline. Our life in the order is bound by discipline. Discipline? And do all knights follow this discipline? St. Clair kicked at a stone. Since you took your vows, have you always observed this discipline? Is this to be a proper confessional? St. Clair asked as he moved along the road, the rabbi following close behind. In your study of the canon, I assume that you read the Song of Songs? Of course, St. Clair replied, relieved to discuss something other than celibacy. And what, in your opinion, is this erotic love poem about? It's neither erotic nor a love poem, Rabbi. It's a mashal, an allegory, for the love that God holds for Israel, that Christ holds for his church. Do you think God would divorce allegory from the thing itself? I've studied the Song of Songs with my order and with Rabbi Jacob of Safed. It has nothing to do with erotic love. Really? What about the passage, your breasts are like two fawns that feed among the lilies? Rabbi Jacob taught that this is a reference to Jewish history. The two breasts represent Aaron and Moses, who provide Israel with nourishment. Please, do you actually believe that? St. Clair turned. Are you saying this interpretation is untrue? True, untrue, it really doesn't matter. In the best traditions of Midrash, what matters is the process of interpreting the Bible in order to extract relevance. What matters is relevance. So what's your interpretation, Rabbi? What do you say the breasts represent? In my learned opinion, Jonathan, the rabbi replied as he frowned and stroked his beard, the breasts represent breasts. So, yes. The Rabbi's Night is a novel which I finished a while back, and it was published about 6 months ago. And along with The Foxes in the Vineyard, I set upon this journey writing in the mid-90s. And I want to basically give you a sense of where I was coming from and why I chose this particular type of history, this particular narrative, because there's obviously connections between the two books. The Rabbi's Night is set in the 13th century. Foxes in the Vineyard is set in 1948. I grew up in the East Bay, and I had an upbringing that was closely allied with synagogue and with Young Judea, which is a Zionist youth group. My earliest memories were having been forced to take Hebrew lessons and to participate in Young Judea after school and on weekends. I eventually, having grown up in this context, emigrated to Israel when I was 18, and I went for a year to attend a Hebrew teacher's seminary in Jerusalem. And one thing led to another, and I eventually stayed. I came, because of the context of my birth and my education, with a singular narrative about Israel, one that I was well-versed in because I had heard it all my life and certainly had been exposed to it both at synagogue as well as in Zionist youth movement, having also attended their national camp in Berryville, New York. there obviously is the miracle of Israel. I was born the same year that Israel was born, and my name in Hebrew is actually Yisroel Mechel, which means Israel Michael. My parents switched it around and anglicized it a bit. But the connection with Israel was very firm, and my infatuation with Israel was very consistent. I also had a very narrow narrative. I had a very Jewish narrative as I moved from the United States to Israel, and I was excited by what I found there. It was a vibrant, small country that was obviously facing tremendous odds as 1966 moved into 1967 and the Six-Day War threatened. This was a very electric time in the Middle East in general, and certainly in Israel in particular, facing really what appeared to be an existential threat. As the years passed, and as the Six-Day War passed, I remained in Israel. And as I remained, I learned more about the land and the other people. Because as I went to a Hebrew university for a couple of years, I began to finally meet Palestinians, both from within Israel as well as from the new territories that were occupied after the 1967 war. And arguing with them, both Israelis and Palestinians, obviously my experience, my knowledge base grew, and I understood that there was another narrative. When I went to medical school in 1969, again, I continued this pattern of education, and I saw that there was obviously a people whose connection and whose sense of suffering certainly was familiar. Because when I went to Israel, I certainly came with a very clear sense of the Jewish sense of dislocation and suffering. And I came to understand that there was also a Palestinian sense of dislocation and suffering. I came to Israel with a sense of the connection to and the love of the land as a Jew. And I certainly saw that the Palestinians had a love of and a connection to the land as well. And after medical school, when I did internship and a year of residency in cardiology in Haifa, I was among a group of people that was headed by the first and at that time the only Palestinian head of a department, Edward Abu Nader, shown here, or barely. He's the tall one in back. And around him are the nurses, the other doctors in the intensive care unit and the cardiology department at the hospital where I did my year of residency. And it's obviously indistinguishable to most, I think, who's Jewish, who's Arab, who's Christian, who's Muslim. This sense of a collective and is actually very common throughout Israel. Even today, many Palestinians turn from being violent resistors to the occupation to understanding the Jewish narrative, especially when they come in contact with the medical system there, because there's really a sense of and I think this is true for doctors in general, that there are no borders and there are no individual people other than the human being that is hurting and needs to be attended to. And that ethos certainly was very evident and something that I really fell in love with. That continued when I came back to the United States to seek my fortune in 1977 and remained. But I kept on going back to Israel, especially more frequently over the last 10 years as I've been doing medical missions in the Palestinian territories. I've also stayed in contact with my old boss, Edward Abu Nader, who is now seen again in this picture in the middle, the pleasant-looking gentleman without the tie. And around him is a fellowship of Christians, Muslims, and Jews. Again, I think it's hard to know who's who, And that's part of the beauty of this type of fellowship and the sense of gathering that does take place throughout Israel. There is a real desire to come together, and there's a genuine pain for the fact that the situation has developed, especially after the two intifadas, not to mention the third currently taking place, which separates people. And this, of course, is a big part of the separation that was felt to be necessary because of the suicide bombings that took place during the Intifada and also between. There's a lot of discussion about whether or not it's a wall or a fence. Well, actually, it's both. As you see here, about 6% is actually wall, and this is mostly in urban areas. And it's very tall, and it basically protects the citizens of Israel from people who would infiltrate and bring harm to them. And it's understandable. It was begun in 94 during the first Intifada, and it increased in its length. And so at present, as you can see, it's now, it extends about 430 miles. In some places where there are open areas that are not urban, it is a multi-layered fence. And 94% is indeed fence. It's a double-layered fence with barbed wire on both sides, with a fence in between, with motion sensors. And in other places, it does have these access roads and anti-vehicle ditches. And so it's a very sophisticated level of protection. And it was felt absolutely by Israelis across the board, right, left, and center, that it was necessary because there needed to be some type of separation in order to have some calm, some breathing space, in order to heal, in order to make peace. And indeed, in the mid-90s, we were moving in that direction. The protection that was afforded by the barrier, this is called the separation barrier, among other things, certainly was very helpful. Because as you can see, it reduced suicide bombings during the Second Intifada from 73 before to only 12. And these, you know, bombings are, of course, horrific. And the loss of life and the destruction of lives, the injuries, certainly made everybody feel it was quite warranted. The problem, however, with the separation barrier is that it also has another agenda. Because it winds into and around the settlements, the growing number of settlements that have been established and are being established. When Oslo was signed in 1993, there were about 110,000 settlers in this area here, the West Bank, the occupied West Bank. And subsequently, especially under Benjamin Netanyahu, that has increased to 400,000. And the dynamic of the separation barrier continues to include many of these areas, sometimes in a very bizarre way, creating situations where it is very difficult for Palestinians to access jobs, access their agricultural areas, access their families, certainly access health care. And without going into detail, because we could talk hours about the impact on daily life in a situation where you can not get from point A to point B any more easily, suffice it to say that there are also enclaves where you basically have a wall around an area, such as here at Bir Nabala, just for example. There are other enclaves as well that are smaller. Here, 15,000 people are in an enclave, which initially, despite the fact that there were access roads to the settlements around the enclave, these were for Israeli use only. Eventually, over the years, passageways were created to connect this enclave with other parts of the West Bank, where there was some freedom of movement. But needless to say, when one had to access any type of job or health care, especially in emergency situations, this was problematic. If you're interested in reading more about this, I would direct you to UN reports from 2005 and 2011 that go into a fair amount of detail as to the impact of the separation barrier and the way it winds through the West Bank and certainly separates communities. Additionally, there are also Arab communities that are on the wrong side of the wall. They're on the Israeli side of the wall. So even though the people living in an Arab village have an identity card and a vehicle on the other, on the West Bank side of the wall, they need special permits in order to go from where they live past where the wall has been placed into the areas where they actually have some type of freedom of movement within the Palestinian Authority. So it's a very convoluted and complex situation that unfortunately is becoming more convoluted and difficult as time goes on and as the settler enterprise increases. There's a lot of talk about the fact that only 1% of the settlements actually occupy land. Just 1% of the land is occupied by settlements. Well, the fact of the matter is that they're zoned for 10%, and 34% of the land, in addition to that, up to 44% then, is basically under the regional council of the settlers. And in addition to that, you have all the access roads that connect the settlements to Israel that accounts for at least another 10, 20%. And so in toto, you have here a situation where you have the West Bank that has been segmented into about 54 separate cantons with sometimes very difficult, occasionally impossible connections between them, again, with all the difficult access issues that we mentioned before. For example, here is the barrier as it passes between Abu Dis and East Jerusalem. Here again, it's a wall. And as you can see here, the average time for an ambulance to travel to the nearest hospital has increased from 10 minutes to about 2 hours. And this obviously poses major problems for people who are trying to give birth and people who are having a heart attack. And there are tragedies that are attendant with that. So, again, the current situation is one where we have these islands of separate entities within an Israeli-controlled area, which clearly creates problems. As somebody who loves Israel, this is painful for me to see this, because Israel here within the Green Line was a democratic country, a vibrant, small, innovative, energetic, argumentative country. Unfortunately, this entity here creates another and very negative dynamic, which saddens many Israelis and many Jews throughout the world. How to grapple with that. There's also the issue of water, which we'll touch on very briefly. Clearly, there's an allocation of water that's problematic. 15%, there are 400,000 settlers within the West Bank. That amounts to 15% of the 2.5 million Arab population in the area. And the settlers get 80% of the water. The 85% of the population gets the 20%, which obviously creates major hardships in regards to the ability to have enough water to drink, to bathe in, to do dishes, etc. In the settlements, of course, you have lush lawns, lovely villas, and this is actually part of the demographic problem, because a lot of Israelis are completely apolitical as they move to the settlements only because you can get very favorable mortgages there, very favorable rates. A person who can barely afford a studio apartment in Tel Aviv can own a villa in because of these preferential relationships in the West Bank. And clearly the disparity is painful to look upon. Apart from the access issues, apart from the water issues, you have the demographic issues of a population that, apart from the economic settlers who are there basically just because they want a nice place to live, either because they're ultra-Orthodox and they want an Orthodox community that's affordable, or they're there for the low mortgages and they're secular. But you also have the Orthodox nationalist movement that basically looks upon this land as ordained by God for the Jewish people. And obviously, whenever you're dealing with a religious discussion, if you're dealing with fundamentalists, there is no room for negotiation. There's basically one point of view frequently, and that point of view is not negotiable. Here's a perversion, for example, of the lyric from Woody Guthrie. It's not "this land is your land, this land is my land, this land is our land, full stop, period." These are just words, though. Whether or not it's graffiti, these are some pictures I took in Hebron, free Hebron from the Arabs. In Hebrew, this is nekama, which means revenge. This is probably the result of the price tag movement among the settlers, where any time there's any movement towards peace or towards some type of negotiated settlement, they basically strike back with either violence or simply with nasty graffiti. This basically just means revenge. This is on a Christian Arab tombstone. This in Hebrew is Mavet la'aravim, which means death to Arabs. This is a little more graphic. Gasp the Arabs, JDL, that's the Jewish Defense League, or Arabs to the gas chambers, or this interesting T-shirt, which is incomprehensible how somebody can get up in the morning and make this fashion statement. Are you Jewish? Question mark. Yes equals life. No equals death. Go figure. In any case, these are just words, though. That unfortunately, words have consequences, and settler violence over the years has increased, both from the standpoint of assaults, destruction of property, assault on places of worship, and raids. And when you are living in this a type of situation where you have an aggressive and fundamentalist group of people who basically don't want the other there at all, you have people who throw rocks, or people who throw eggs, or people who throw some type of red liquid on a woman here in Hebron, or people who harass an old lady, in this case children, sadly, or people who are doing something here with a stretching out an Arab child. Perhaps he threw a rock, and they're holding him. Or this could just be some Israeli chiropractors doing a spinal adjustment on a child here. And here, obviously, harassing a woman in Hebron. And this is a picture I took, actually, in the pediatric intensive care unit at the Makassid Hospital in East Jerusalem. This little girl was playing by the separation barrier in her town of Anata, which is by the Israeli settlement of Anatot, and someone shot her in the neck. I reviewed the chart when I was there. I was actually called to see her because she had a fungal infection, and I was basically doing an echocardiogram in order to rule out any type of involvement of the heart, any type of vegetations in the heart. Her heart was fine. Unfortunately, her spinal cord was not. She was quadriplegic, and when I came back for another mission, in 4 months, she had already died. So these are the unfortunate victims of a situation that many of us hope would end. One way of fighting back against this is to do what one can. And for me, this means volunteering my time with the Palestine Children's Relief Fund. A colleague of mine, who actually is in the East Bay, Ziad Saba, who's originally from Gaza, who is a pediatric cardiologist, told me about this opportunity. And as soon as my children were old enough to do their homework on their own and didn't want me around anymore, I started doing missions. This was about 10 years ago. The Palestine Children's Relief Fund was founded by Steve Sosaby, seen with his two daughters and his wife, Huda El Masri. They founded this about 15 years ago. Huda is a social worker, and Steve was basically a journalist student from Kent University who came to Israel and Palestine in order to experience the situation there as a journalist student, and fell in love with Palestine and fell in love with Huda. And they were married, lived in Ramallah, and had two beautiful daughters. Unfortunately, Huda contracted leukemia about 7 years ago, and she died about 3 years ago, leaving Steve with the two daughters, but a wonderful legacy of this NGO, which provides free medical pediatric subspecialty care for children of Palestine. In that context, I go about twice a year. I examine kids either in Ramallah here or here. And these are some of the mothers and kids, the especially photogenic ones. I also have done surgical missions at Nakasset Hospital in East Jerusalem, as here. This is Italian cardiovascular surgical mission. This was with a British mission, and here there's a sign out between the operating room anesthesiologist and the intensivist in the unit, which again was created at the hospital by donations from the Palestine Children's Relief Fund. And here's a nice surgical outcome, a child prior to discharge. This is the type of response that certainly I find personally rewarding and something that I really can't do without. And it basically goes back to something that this guy said in regards to how Jews should respond to what we've been through, to our narrative. And here, for example, in a letter to Chaim Weizmann in 1923, Einstein wrote, "If we are not able to find a way to honest cooperation and honest pacts with the Arabs, then we have learned nothing during our 2,000 years of suffering. Without honest cooperation with the Arabs, there is no peace and no security." Are we almost done? Give me another five, right? Thank you. Let me just read this one because this is especially poignant for myself. This is a letter to another Zionist, Hugo Berkman, in 1930. This was after the riots in Palestine in 1929, by the way. "The Zionist goal gives us an actual opportunity to put into practice through a viable solution of the Jewish-Arab problem those principles of tolerance and justice that we owe primarily to our prophets. I am convinced that the living transmission of those principles is the most important thing in Judaism," to which I concur. Not only the prophets, but also in the liturgy. For example, we're all familiar with the many passages in the five books of Moses about loving the stranger in your midst. For example, in Leviticus here, "And if a stranger sojourn with you in your land, you shall not wrong him. The stranger that sojourns with you shall be unto you as the homeborn among you, and you shall love him as thyself, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt." We'll soon celebrate Passover, and clearly, you know, this is a theme that resonates very strongly, or certainly should resonate very strongly among Jews throughout the world. And in regards to one of my favorite passages from a prophet, without going through the entire beginning of the verse, which is actually quite interesting because the irony of this is great. Here, the writer is asking God, if he'll please with 1,000 rams, with rivers of oil, giving my firstborn for my transgression, for the fruit of my body, for the sin of my soul. And the answer to this is, you know, we don't need all that. No, thank you very much. All we ask is that you know what is good and what the Lord requires of you, to do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly. And it's this type of ethos that certainly I think is sorely needed in that part of the world. A wonderful quotation from Martin Luther King Jr. relates to the fact that darkness cannot drive out darkness, only light can do that. Hatred cannot drive out hatred, only love can do that. And it's this light and this love that I hope to, in small measure, bring to the equation. We saw years ago, for many of us it was very thrilling to see this handshake, although it was a little uncomfortable perhaps, but this handshake at the Declaration of Principles signing in September of 1993, with Yasser Arafat and Yitzhak Rabin. It was followed a year later by the signing of the peace treaty with Jordan. When I showed these slides to my mother, she said, "Oh, that's you." I said, "No, Mom, it's King Hussein." who's shaking hands with Yitzhak Rabin here. And actually, it was the impetus of Rabin's assassination at the hands of an ultra-nationalist Jewish man. A year after this, in November of, actually November of that year, that Rabin was shot with two bullets from a Beretta pistol in the back. And for many of us, this firstborn is Sabra, you know, native-born Israeli prime minister of Israel, was an iconic figure. He'd obviously been a young soldier. Here he is as a commander in the Palmach. That's the elite strike force of the Haganah, of the Jewish Defense Force, before the state. Here he's 26 years old in 1948, August 22nd, which happens to be my birthday. For anybody wanting to know how many shopping days you have. Here he is with his wife, Leah, on the day of their wedding. And here is a picture I took of their gravesite on Har Herzl, Mount Herzl in Jerusalem, with Leah and Yitzhak side by side. So in the mid-90s is basically when this tragedy occurred, because it was not only the death of Rabin, it was also the death of the peace process, unfortunately. And the type of credibility that Rabin brought to the process was formidable. And I don't know that we have a leader right now in Israel who can match that gravitas. Unfortunately, even the credibility of somebody like Rabin, with his curriculum vitae, his pedigree, in regards to defending the state religiously, I might say, and very carefully. Even when he was a diplomat in the United States, they always said that he always thought like a general, always thought strategically, even about peace negotiations. But unfortunately, even he was not, in quotation marks, good enough for the ultra-nationalists, ultra-religious. And it was on that basis that I basically began writing in the mid-90s. The connecting thread, as you can see from the covers of the books, is Jerusalem. And not so much the Jerusalem of this world, because in Kabbalistic thought, there's this sense of above and below, the upper and lower, in this case, upper Jerusalem and lower Jerusalem. And the connecting thread is not so much between the Jerusalem of this world, the lower Jerusalem, which is basically a bone of contention in what seems an unending conflict, a city of dirt and stone and bad smells sometimes. It's basically the upper Jerusalem that we look towards. And this basically is a place where we meet our best selves and our better angels. And it's this connecting thread that connects the books and certainly connects me with this very special part of the world. This is not only something that we as Jews feel, that connection is certainly felt by Muslims and by Christians throughout the world. And so this common point of reference is something that I invoke in these two books and the next one coming that will be entitled Sins of the Fathers, coming soon to a bookstore near you, perhaps. In any case, with that, I conclude, and I think we're going to open up to conversation.
Yes, we'd like to thank Dr. Michael Cooper, author of The Rabbi's Knife, for his presentation. And it is time to open it up to questions from the audience. Several questions relate, of course, to the book, and but also about Israel in general. And one question is, if a two-state solution is ever reached, where would the borders be most easily defined? And I know, you know, you've had the luxury of not only going to Israel quite a bit, but continuing to go there. So this is more than an academic exercise for you. And I think we get that in your presentation. I mean, so if you were sort of in the place of, you know, Israeli and Arab leaders, how would you redefine the borders?
Well, I think the borders are pretty well agreed upon, and everybody knows what the solution will look like, more or less. It basically involves the 67 borders with land swaps. That is, Israel taking many, not all, but many of the large built-up settlement areas. I won't go into detail because, A, no one knows exactly what they are, and, B, I don't have time or the knowledge to tell you which they are. But ultimately, many of the large and built-up settlement areas would be included in Israel, and at pro quo, the Palestinians would receive land that is currently in Israel. The fate of Jerusalem is obviously an interesting question, and many believe, certainly myself included, that since it's a very special place on the planet for the three Abrahamic faiths, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, it should be something that belongs to not only those three faiths, but the world. And initially, when the UN was trying to figure out how to partition Palestine in 1947, they came up with the expression, a corpus separatum, a separate entity. And I think this would be probably a good way to administer the old city of Jerusalem with a Israeli capital in West Jerusalem and a Palestinian capital in East Jerusalem beyond the old city, but something along those lines.
Several people ask about the book, The Rabbi's Night, and the questions could be funneled through this idea of history. Of course, I mean, you're writing about history, and in The Rabbi's Night, you know, Saladin comes into play.
He's about 200 years before this takes place.
Right. Okay. But right. So but he mentioned of him certainly in the book. But you know, again, without giving too much away, there are characters in the book who, despite their backgrounds of difference, get along quite well. And there's war, there's sex in the book, actually implied.
Nothing graphic.
Implied, and there's actually love and hatred, so it's sort of got the full spectrum. What did you want to include in the book that, in a sense, does relate to your present views of the Middle East, or did you have to sort of edit yourself?
What's wonderful about writing historical fiction at this particular point in history is that some of the characters who are historical are fairly well known. For example, Isaac of Akko is a well-known Kabbalistic scholar who here is a 17-year-old kid. This, again, is historical. Another historical figure is William Wallace, who, again, comes with the Jews of York who have been thrown out of England by Edward Longshanks in 1290. That happens, again, historical fact. And all the Jews of England were exiled. And so William Wallace basically shepherds a group of these exiled Jews from the city of York to Palestine, along with Templar sailors. That's how he comes into the picture. What I wanted to do in relation to the relationships, especially the relationship between Jonathan Sinclair, who is a fictional, although the Sinclair or Sinclair lineage that's also a connecting thread between the two books is also very important in Templar as well as Freemasonry lore. So that's a fictional character, and I can basically create him in the context of this particular situation. But Rabbi Samuel is not a fictional character. He's historical. But in the Encyclopedia Judaica, there's only about four lines written about him because very little is known. And here one can therefore embellish. All is known about him is that in 1288 he wrote two letters excommunicating or threatening to excommunicate a rabbi in Akko, Solomon Pettit, because of the Maimonidean controversy with Pettit having crossed the line. He was a Jew from France. This is all historical. What's wonderful about writing about Rabbi Samuel from Baghdad is that this amazing character is unknown in regards to anything beyond these few lines in the encyclopedia. There's no more history. So it was an honor to be able to channel this amazing figure and to give him a heroic, albeit fictional, history, because he didn't have one. the relationships, though, between Isaac of Ockham and William Wallace, between Jonathan St. Clair and the rabbi, are very special, because, again, and also between the rabbi and Al-Hassani, who is an Arab mathematician and physician and cartographer. These are important relationships for me to put forward, because, again, they stress the sense of reconciliation, the sense of friendship. As Herman Melvin will put it in Chlorel, an epic poem that he wrote after visiting the Holy Land, this is the intersympathy of faiths that I think is very extant and very real, and something that I wanted to hearken to. This intersympathy of faiths, this sense of closeness, this recognition and this respect that major religions can and should have for each other.
We'd like to remind our listening audiences that this is a Commonwealth Club program called The Rabbi's Night, and our speaker is Dr. Michael J. Cooper. I'm Jonathan Gurriel, moderator for today's presentation. We have several questions about, one relates to how religious scholars, how would consider your take on the Song of Solomon. And I'm wondering, you know, you're not writing a history book, right? You're writing an interpretation and a kind of, you know, expansive fantasy, in a sense. Or are you?
As historical fiction, obviously I have to basically remain within the context of history. I didn't want to put in, too many notes. I didn't want to put any notes in. What I do have, though, are the various historical and fictional characters all listed in regards to some of their biographies. So that basically is the touchstone of the historical aspect. As regarding the Song of Songs, I'm not exactly sure what the question is.
What do religious scholars say about your take on the Song of Solomon?
Religious scholars haven't weighed in on my... The fact remains that the Song of Songs is beautiful, erotic, in and of itself. It is also allegorical and beautiful. And as evidenced in the discussion between St. Clair and the rabbi, there's lots of ways of interpreting it. And again, one can certainly come up with all kinds of ways of looking at this epic love poem that don't necessarily involve carnality in any way. And all of it is relevant to a degree. The Jewish scholarship community has yet to weigh in on my interpretation, and I really don't necessarily offer an interpretation. Basically, it's a conversation. I think that they would look upon it favorably.
Did you find in researching the book that you encountered things about history that surprised you, and in fact, might have even changed your view about certain things? And if so, did you include that in your book?
What surprised me is how figures appeared to leap out of the histories that I was reading and to almost insist upon being included in the book, whether or not it's William Wallace in the year 1290, who had been at the time about 17 or 18 years old, according to the scant histories that we know about him early in life, or Rabbi Samuel himself, Rabbi Pettit. All of these characters sort of basically emerged. I kind of knew where I wanted to go in relation to emphasizing that intersympathy of creeds that was central to the basic message of the book. And it was lovely to be able to have these characters. Al-Hassani is basically sort of a conglomerate of the many amazing scientists, mathematicians and physicians that came out of the Arab world, while Europe was sort of, suffering through the Dark Ages. There was obviously a major awakening in these sciences in the Arab world, and I certainly wanted to bring that knowledge as well as the friendship that existed between many Arabs and Jews in that part of the world at that point in time.
Your book there, Rabbi's Night, gets into questions, of course, about the Crusades. And in your in the Rabbi's Night, you pose questions, and there are lots of debates that happen, lots of conversations. There's a lot of dialogue in the book. And in a sense, are you, in a sense, providing more an avenue for debate rather than answers, you know, through this work of fiction?
In regards to the Crusades, and specifically in relation to the Knights Templar, there's a lot of, misconceptions about who they were and how, you know, some of them, you know, left the path of their original calling, which basically, when they were founded at the end of the 11th century on the Temple Mount, in the Temple of Solomon, we have that right over there, they were basically known as the Poor Knights of the Temple of Solomon. Their emblem, just to show their poverty, was two knights riding on a single horse, just to show how poor they were. They couldn't afford two horses, so they had to double them up. Their calling was to protect pilgrims coming to and going from the Holy Land. And it's this calling that was central to the original Knights Templar. There's a lot of misconceptions about who they became thereafter. One of the interesting tenets of the Templars was the rule of Bernard, and in referencing Bernard of Clairvaux, Saint Bernard, who basically is looked upon, and this is actually from the Encyclopedia Judaica, as a righteous Gentile, because he rose from his sick bed when Jews were being attacked along the Rhine by crusaders marauding through the countryside, killing infidels on their way to the Holy Land. He rose up and he protected Jews from this type of savagery, basically saying that what you do to these people, you're basically doing to Christ. And the rule of Templar was central to the calling of the Knights Templar. So this is something I did also wanted to highlight, and I think that's mentioned in the book. Because, you know, clearly there were excesses beyond belief in relation to what was visited upon the Muslims in the Holy Land, as well as Jews on the road to the Holy Land by crusaders.
We have time for one final question. Your presentation got into a lot of statistics that really reveal the side of the Middle East I think a lot of people, you know, aren't aware of or aren't reminded of that often. One question from the audience is how Israel can be both religiously based and also democratic, and whether the two are contradictory. Certainly the same could be said of a lot of countries, but I wonder if you want to answer that question.
Yeah, that's truly an interesting and complex question, and an important one. A Jewish state, what does that mean? Clearly, from the standpoint of the Jewish people, as well as other, you know, ethnic groups throughout the world, whether or not it's Armenians or others, there's a yearning, a longing for a homeland. In this case, you know, for Israel, it was this particular bit of real estate. When they tried to create Uganda as an alternative, it never really caught fire. Other Jewish enclaves were established both in Europe as well as in the Soviet Union. But, you know, clearly there was a yearning for Zion, a yearning for this traditional place on the planet. I think that there is, and I feel as a Jew, there is definitely an importance of a place for the Jewish people, just as there's a vitality and importance for Armenians and other people of different ethnic groups. The issue of how to walk the fine line between a religion and a democracy without becoming a theocracy is very interesting, and it continues to be a dynamic, especially with religious parties in coalition governments in Israel, where they frequently hold the key to major decisions, because if they don't go with the government, the government basically will lose a vote of no confidence, and the government will be gone. And, you know, clearly that is an unhealthy situation. And many Israelis would like to see a more secular Jewish state, but nevertheless a Jewish state. What that is at, defined at as is very complex and difficult to navigate. Clearly, we have our own calendar, which can be included, our own holidays, which can be included, but there can and must be a sense of inclusiveness with all branches of Judaism, and that's something that's currently being debated and struggled over, because right now, for Reform Jews and for Conservative Jews and for Reconstructionist Jews and other branches other than the Orthodox, there's a very difficult road to hoe in being included in religious life in Israel. I think once that becomes a more, and this sounds oxymoronic, secularized Jewish state, it will be a lot healthier for everybody. But it must and can, I think, exist. And I think that is the starting point of any negotiation.
Now it's time to thank Dr. Michael J. Cooper for his presentation, The Rabbi's Night, which is the title of his latest novel. We also thank our audiences here, those listening to the recording and on the internet, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 112 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.